Okay, tonight is the eighth night of Hanukkah. And we're supposed to do, I'm starting two classes on suffering. But really, how could you talk about suffering on the eighth night of Hanukkah? But I figured out a way. So.
You're so sorry.
Yeah, so read the story later. We're not going to necessarily, I wanted to give you the article, but we're not going to read that in class. Maybe I'll read one paragraph, we'll see. But that's for you to take home. So we do have two classes on suffering. And we're going to talk about it at length, but tonight I want to talk about it in the context of Hanukkah, because how could we not use this opportunity? So let's start out with a quote, which will bring us right into Hanukkah and suffering altogether. So that quote is Rabbi Yochanan said, "In what way is Israel compared to an olive? Just as an olive cannot give forth oil without being crushed, so too Israel will not return to the proper path without suffering." So, there's a few different types of suffering that we Jews think about, and we'll talk about different types, but I want to put them into two major categories for tonight, and that is productive suffering and restorative suffering. Those are the two major categories, and you can break each of those categories down, but tonight we're going to talk more about productive suffering. So productive suffering is suffering that takes you to where you need to go, as opposed to fixes you up from where you shouldn't have gone. So it's interesting that this quote, those are the two types. So this quote, actually, I want to use it as productive rather than as restorative, even though it's really a restorative quote. So the concept of suffering, it's interesting because we have this, I'm not even sure where it's from, but there is a discussion of how suffering comes into the world. And it's that Yitzchak asks for it. So, and so God says, okay, Yitzchak understands that suffering is good, and we'll probably talk about that more at length next time, because that's more restorative suffering that he's asking for. But he understands suffering is good, and he asks that suffering should come into the world. So apparently our three avot, our three forefathers, asked for certain things. So Abraham asked for aging. There wasn't aging before Abraham. Yitzchak asked for suffering. And Yaakov asked for sickness. Yaakov asked for sickness. I see your inquisitive faces. He asked for sickness because it used to be people would just, this is why we say bless you after somebody sneezes. Somebody would sneeze and die. So it was inconvenient to just die like that. So Yaakov felt that it would be more convenient if you would kind of know that death is coming up, and be able to get your affairs in order, bless your children, etc., tie up loose ends, that might be more convenient. So he asked for there to be sickness. And so God brought sickness into the world. Yitzchak asked for suffering. So he said, God said, okay, and let's start with you. And he became old and blind. And Abraham asked for aging because apparently you couldn't tell. It was hard for people to see the difference between Yitzchak and Abraham because of the aging process. You didn't age as an adult. So whatever that means, I don't believe we take that literally. And I was just thinking about Yitzchak on the way over. Was there no suffering before Yitzchak asked for suffering? I mean, we have instances in the Torah where people suffered before that. So what was that suffering? So I think he was asking for restorative, and I think there was probably productive suffering before that. But I haven't done an analysis. I was just thinking about it. So, but what I want to talk about is suffering as a productive value and where we see that. So we know right away, it's woven into the very beginning of the Torah, which we're going to see in a minute, that there's going to be four exiles. Exiles are about suffering, right? They're about making it difficult for us. And it is, we'll see that most of the suffering that we encounter is a mixture of both types. But it says in the second verse of the Torah, which we don't have, but I'll just quote you. Oh, I did write it here for you. And the earth was unformed and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. Right? So in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth was unformed and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. Right? So our sages say that you can see an allusion to the four exiles in that verse. So the first one is unformed. The second one is void. The third one is darkness. And the fourth one is deep. The concept of four exiles runs throughout Jewish literature and throughout Jewish thought. And so we'll go through those four exiles and see how they affect us and what the Hanukkah exile, Hanukkah is one of the exiles, what that was about. So the Babylonian exile was the first one. The first exile came after the destruction of the first temple. So the first temple is destroyed, and the Jews are exiled from their land, taken out, and sent to Babylon. That was the way the Babylonians worked conquering. They conquered the land, exiled the inhabitants of the land so that they'd be less likely to join together in an uprising. And even if they would join together in an uprising, they wouldn't really know the land very well, so they would be less successful in the type of warfare that was fought at the time. Put them in a foreign land so that they don't feel like it's theirs and they need to defend it, so that they don't know everybody who lives there, so they can't join with them, and so they don't know the land, so that they can't use it as an advantage. They don't have a home court advantage in war. So they were exiled to Babylon. So that's exile number one. Exile number two follows closely on the heels of exile number one. In fact, we didn't actually go back in between. So exile number two is the Persian exile, and that's the Purim story that you may be familiar with, the story of Esther. So basically what happened was Babylon was overrun by the Persians. The Persians are in charge, so the Jews stayed in the same place, but the leadership changed. With the change of leadership came a change in the way the Jews were led and everybody else around them. So the second exile, the Purim story, was an exile in which the Jews were, there was a decree of death, a genocidal decree. So all the Jews were supposed to be killed in the Persian Empire, which is where the Jews now found themselves. You know the story about the peasants, the Polish peasants, who, you know, the borders were constantly changing, Russia, Poland, Poland, Russia. And so one day, one comes home, I wish I could think of Polish names, but comes home and says to his friend, "Guess what? They changed the borders. We're back in Poland." And his friend says, "Oh, thank God, I can't take another one of those Russian winters." So, meanwhile, that's what was happening to the Jews. They went from being under Babylonian rule to being under Persian rule, and the decree of destruction that came with that. Then back to the land of Israel. Not all the Jews went back, but that's for a history class, so that's another time. But those who did go back started to rebuild the Second Temple. And in the Second Temple period, during the time the Second Temple stood, is when we had the Greek exile. The Greeks came, they took over. Basically, they allowed puppet governors, Jewish governors, but basically they were Hellenizing their kingdom. The Jews were extremely attracted to their philosophy. It's interesting to note that the Jews are swayed by intellectually beautiful philosophies and not by boorish societies. So when the Jews went into Babylon, there was no assimilation. The Jews looked down upon the Babylonians. They were disgusting people, according to the Jews. According to the Talmud, they were like hairy bears. You know, they ate rough and they dressed rough and they behaved rough and they weren't attractive to the Jews. There wasn't a danger of assimilation. But the Greeks were refined and beautiful. They had art and poetry, literature and drama, mathematics and science, and the Jews were swept up with that. They loved it. So the Jews were leaving Judaism and going to the Greek philosophies. So that's what was happening in the land of Israel with the temple standing.
There's stories about that. Years ago I heard stories about that. They even go to the Greek athletics.
That's right, they did. They even joined, right, which is why today in the right-wing religious world, you still will have some controversy over sport because of this Greek period and because of what sport means, not the healthy kind of sport that we think about, but the kind of sport where they did it with naked bodies and it was all about, you know, aggrandizing the body and showing off the body and being all about being physical and being beautifully physical because it was about the aesthetics, which is why, for instance, they opposed circumcision because that takes away from the beauty of the human form. So the Jews were very swayed and swept up in the Greek culture. There were those who stayed behind, I mean, stayed in the Torah, rooted in Torah, but it was a smallish group. And as the Jews and the Greeks took control, so they took control of the temple also. Now, the temple itself was not destroyed by the Greeks, meaning we hear the children's stories where once the Maccabees won, they had to go in and clean the temple up, and you think about them uprighting pillars and cleaning it out, every the mess that they made. They didn't make a mess. They were Greeks. They loved beauty. The temple was gorgeous. They weren't going to go in and mess it up. They were going to go in and use it for their gods. So they desecrated it, but spiritually desecrated, not physically. So it was only a spiritual thing. So there was no cleaning up that had to happen. What had to happen was the rededication to Jewish purpose, the rescuing from Greek purpose and the rededication to Jewish purpose. But it wasn't a physical mess. It was a spiritual mess that had to be cleaned up. The fourth exile is the Roman exile. That's the one that began at the end of the destruction, the end of the Second Temple period, the destruction of the Second Temple, and that is the exile that we are still in today. It's the longest, obviously, 2,000 years and counting. The others were pretty short. If you think about it, between the Babylonian exile and the end of the Persian exile, between the two temples was approximately, a drop more maybe, but depending on how you count, approximately 70 years. So Babylonian and Persian exiles had to share those 70 years, however you divide it. I think Babylonian was longer than Persian, but basically they shared those 70 years. The Greek exile was also pretty short, even if you want to count the entire Hellenistic period and not just the period of the Hanukkah revolt itself. So you could maybe stretch it to 100 years at the most, but really it was less than that. So that's also a pretty short exile, certainly compared to what we're living in now, 2,000 years. So that's why, if you want to look back at our verse then, one more thing to talk about, the essence of what each exile was trying to obliterate. So the Babylonian exile, as we said, they exiled us physically. They took us out of our land. In taking us out of our land, they were trying to disconnect us from the land that we were given, which we'll see in the next class. Disconnect us from that land that we were given and disconnect us from our temple and from our service. They didn't tell us we can't keep our religion, but they did take us out of our land. So outside the land of Israel, you can't. It's not that they didn't tell us we mayn't keep our religion, but they made it so that we can't as much by taking us out of the land. We didn't have access to the temple. We didn't have all the rules of the land of Israel, how you tithe the produce and give it to the poor and all the things that you can, all the mitzvot that are dependent on living in the land were taken away from us. So we don't think of that as a big loss because we live here in Denver, Colorado. We don't have access to any of those mitzvot. But actually, that's quite a large body. When you talk about 613 mitzvot, that's about 400 of them. So we have 613 mitzvot plus small print. So the small print is like a lot of the stuff that we're doing today. But about 400 of the big 613 are land and temple related. So all of that was taken away by the exile, by the physical exile. So they're trying to take away our connection, really, to each other, to the land, to the temple. The Persian exile, obviously, they're trying to take away our lives, right? So they also didn't say that we can't worship our gods, but what they're saying is you can't be alive, so that's going to be gone. It will be a moot point. The Greek exile is an interesting exile because what they did was we're still in our land. Now, the Greeks did make decrees. They wanted to Hellenize. So their decrees, some of the decrees that they made were no Shabbos, no Rosh Chodesh, no circumcision, no Bris Milah, and no learning Torah. So no Shabbos because that sanctifies time. So if you can take out a seventh of your life and withdraw from that physical, creative participation on the planet, making things go. That's what we refrain from on Shabbos, is making things go. And we say, God makes it go, whether or not I do. I can step back and God will make it go while I don't. Right? So you're acknowledging God, you're sanctifying time, and you're saying that there's a spiritual component to life. So that had to get taken away. Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh also, the whole concept of Rosh Chodesh is the concept of constant renewal. It's Chodesh, month. The root of the word is Chadash, new. The Jewish concept of Rosh Chodesh is that you always have a new start. Just as the moon waxes and wanes, it looks like it's completely gone, and then it comes back. It's always making a fresh start, coming into its fullness, and then shedding pieces again, and then coming into its fullness again, and then waxing and waning, constantly renewing. So we Jews understand that human beings all have the opportunity to constantly reinvent themselves. If you count time by the sun, you believe that the world is the same. However you are is how you are. The word for year, shana, like Rosh Hashanah, means to repeat, to do it again and again and again, rather than to renew, chodesh, chadash, right? A month where you make it new all the time. So year is about repeating, sun counting is about repetition, staying the same, and month counting is about renewal. So Rosh Chodesh is that concept of innovation, which is, it's hardwired into the Jew. If you look at who we are, even if we're not spiritually innovating, we can't stop innovating, whether it's in science or computers or medical things or literature or ideas, whatever it is around the world, we're just constantly innovating. That's how we vibrate on the innovation level. So Rosh Chodesh, they want to take that away from us. Bris Milah, circumcision. So that says, that's a few things. First of all, that's marring the body, right? But second of all, that's saying, I have a responsibility to use this body responsibly. And I can't just go in any direction that that organ's going to take me. I have to say, no, you only get to go in the direction where I choose to let you go, right? But so I'm going to cut you back and say, I am not led by you. I lead you. Right? So that's what circumcision is about, is saying I'm not a part of the society around. So the circumcision really has three steps. There's a cutting away, there's an exposing of the tip, then, and there's also a drawing forth of the blood. I'm not sure about the third step, although that's an important step, and that's the step that differentiates our circumcision practice from the Muslim circumcision practice. They only have two steps, the cutting and the revealing. But the cutting is about saying I'm not part of that practice, and the revealing is saying I am part of that practice. You can't just define yourself in contradistinction to everybody else. I'm not that. You have to define yourself, I am that. But first you have to know what you're not, and then you can know what you are. So circumcision is about that, saying I'm not just led by that. But the whole Greek society was very hedonistic and very much about enjoying the flesh and the physical. And so that had to go too. And learning Torah, of course, is the thing that vivifies everything, right? If you learn Torah, so then it gives life to all of these practices, to all of these understandings. It keeps you connected in the ability to renew, in the ability to sanctify time, in the ability to sanctify your body, in the ability to create relationships of renewal. That's all rooted in learning Torah. So that had to go too. So they did make those decrees. But they didn't decree that we had to die. And they didn't decree that we couldn't have temple service. It just had to be their temple service. So they were still interested in the beauty of Judaism, but from an aesthetic point of view, not from the spiritual root point of view. And then so what they were after was our minds. Really? Right? They weren't after our body or, in a way, our soul, because they saw that we could still be religious, just be their religious. So they didn't want to take away religion, just they didn't want to take away the exclusivity. The Greeks were about conquer and absorb. That's the way they worked, right? So when they, and the Romans too, Pax Romana, right? Roman peace was about conquering and bringing everybody under the same umbrella. It's kind of like Pax Islam, right? The Islamic concept of peace is the whole world will be in peace when the whole world's under the Islamic umbrella, right? So that there will be peace when everybody is under our law. But it's a little different than the Greco-Roman version, which was conquer and absorb. They didn't make people give up their religion. They just absorbed it in. They were pagans, so that was okay with them. Just keep expanding. Just parenthetically, but also for a history class, by the end of the Second Temple period, when they had been doing this quite a bit, their pagan religion was quite expanded, quite bloated, and very uncomfortable and cumbersome to deal with all those gods and all those traditions and all those holidays. It was just too much. And plus, they weren't stupid. You know, so it really was getting stupid. It was just idiotic. I mean, here's a bunch of smart people. And looking at that, the way paganism developed till that point, it was getting ridiculous. And they were really ready for a one-god system. But there really only was one, and that was Judaism, which is hard. It has a lot of mitzvahs and a lot of restrictions. Nobody was really interested in that, which is really what set the stage for Christianity, which was monotheism light, right? It was really, people were ready for that. They needed it, right? And that's why it took off like wildfire. And that's how that got bastardized also, because when they took on Christianity, a little battle, 300-year gap there. But once they took it on, they then continued with the Greco-Roman version of conquer and absorb. So we now conquer with Christianity, but absorb some of the pagan cultures and ideas into it. Hence, we have Christmas and Easter with bunnies and trees. You know, where does that come from? That comes from conquering and absorbing and mixing in and bringing and saying, yes, you can keep your pagan rituals. We'll just call it Santa Claus, you know, and we'll make it your winter light festival into lighting a Christmas tree. You know, that works for us. So anyway, that's how that happened. So the end of that is the Roman exile. So now we have the Greek exile. We reconquer our territory, reconquer emotionally, spiritually, physically, but not for long. It's pretty short-lived. And the Romans come and take over. The Romans then destroy the temple, kick us out, well, do a lot of killing and exiling. There's a remnant left over in the land. But basically, the Romans kick us out, and here we are in this long exile where really we've experienced all of that. Right? They're after our mind. They're after our soul. They're after our body. Depending on where we are and when we are, we've been exposed to all of that all mixed together. So, any questions up to this point? Did you have a thought? No? Okay. Excuse me. So in thinking about these three, so I wrote down here soul, body, and intellect clarity. That's really what they were after, Babylonian after not really after the soul, but bringing us out after the connection. So it was a soul connection. The Persians after the body, and the Greeks after the intellect clarity, the Romans after all three. So now let me ask you. Imagine it's Sesame Street and we're playing that game. One of these things is not like the other. Okay, so you've got four, and one is not like the other. So four exiles, one is not like the other. So I'll just point out the Roman exile is not like the others because it's so long. But there's another exile that's not like the others. Tell me which one that is. Why?
Because they had a decree of death. And the other ones, they just took us out of the land physically, and the Greeks didn't let us worship how we wanted, and the Romans, I'm not sure I understood that one.
Oh, so the Romans included the decree of death.
Oh, they did?
The Romans did all three.
Oh. Okay.
But you did say one thing that would hint. There is one of these that's totally different than the others.
First one.
How?
They took us out of the land.
Well, so usually an exile is taking you out of the land. That's what I want to get to here, is the Greek exile. Where were we during the Greek exile?
In Israel,
right? The rest of them, exile usually means you're kicked out.
In Palestine,
whatever. We're in the land of Israel, right? Usually exile means you're out of your space. Right? So the Babylonian, out of our space. Persian, out of our space. Roman, out of our space. Greek, in our space. So how is that an exile?
Because we couldn't do our stuff.
So something else was exiled. Our bodies weren't exiled. Our mind was exiled. Right? It was a different type of exile. Now let's go and look back up at this verse, okay? So the earth was unformed. That's Babylonian exile. That's the null. That's taking unformed. You take this people and take them away from what forms them. Take them out of their land, out of their temple service, out of their form. So unformed is Babylonian. Persian, void. Kill them. Wipe them out. Right? Greek, darkness. Darken their eyes. Darken their intellect. Make it so they can't see with clarity what they're supposed to be doing. But you're leaving them in the land. You're not attacking body. You're attacking intellect and clarity of vision. And then Roman is deep, because it's so long, what's at the bottom of it? You can't even see where it is. In a couple of classes, you're going to learn about Jacob's dream with Rabbi Liban. So when you get to that, you'll see his dream. He has a ladder, and the angels are going up and down. So there's a lot of different symbolisms woven into that dream. But one of them is that the angels each represent an exile. And so he sees one go up and down. And another one go up and down. And another one go up and down. That's the three shorter ones we talked about. And then one goes up, and he never sees it go down. It just goes up and up and disappears. And he gets very nervous. And he says, what's with that angel that goes up and up and up? Is there no end? Does that exile never end? And so we don't know the answer to that yet. We know it's going to end, but we don't know when. It just goes up and up. It's very deep.
I struggle with the idea of the Roman exile still today after we have the state of Israel.
Right. Okay, so that's an excellent question. I'm glad you asked that. So in looking at the state of Israel, would you say that the Jews own and run the land with the entire world recognizing it and with even us Jews recognizing it, getting along with each other and using the land of Israel for what it's supposed to be, the beacon of light, the place, the center of the world, really, the confluence of three continents and an ocean. So it's the place through which all the trade goes and ideas can then spread to the world. So are we using that land to connect to each other, to connect to God, to be leaders in the world, to be a light unto the nations? Or are we still exiled? We just happen to live there right now. The ideas aren't actually working yet. The connection's not actually working yet. We still actually don't have the land. We're fighting for it every single day. You know?
Okay, so then I have a difficulty with kind of the right-wing, ultra-Orthodox, non-Zionist
approach.
Which there's still a lot of.
Yes,
that.
Yes. There's very few anti-Zionists left, but there's plenty of non-Zionists still today. Yes, yes.
There's plenty.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, so that
Lakewood, New Jersey.
Absolutely. Yes, Denver, Colorado, too. So
they believe that we're not ready, right? I mean, in a nutshell, we're not ready for Israel to be what Israel's supposed to be. So then how can you reconcile being a Zionist and say we're still in exile? That's the part I'm not.
How can you recognize being a Zionist and saying we're still in exile? Well, so if you understand, and that's a historical question for a history class. We'll see how long I'll spend on that answer. it's an excellent question, though. So Herzl's idea of Zionism, which is Herzl's idea, because Zionism is not a Jewish idea. It's an idea of a Jewish man, Herzl. So the concept of Yishuv Haaretz is the Jewish idea, that we were given the land, that the land belongs to us, that we need to use that land for a reason, so that we have a right to the land, but for a reason, and it's ours, and we should live there, especially because 400 of those mitzvot are dependent on the land. And so our best expression as individual Jews and as a Jewish people and as beacons and leaders in the world can only be made through inhabiting the land and doing everything that's necessary in the land. That is a Jewish concept, a Torah concept. The desire to return to Zion all these years has been to that. Right? So now the political concept came about with Herzl, who, by the way, didn't even circumcise his own children. He was not religious at all. Right? So his entire beginning of Zionism was completely a political thing, and it was really an answer to how do we Jews get out from under this suffering, which was the main question at that time period. And so one answer was reform, one answer was assimilate, one answer was move back into extreme Torah observance, you know, and just accept the suffering, which we'll talk about more. But And Herzl's answer was, at first, assimilate completely. That was his initial answer for himself. If I want to get out from under, another answer was convert, right? But Herzl's personal answer from how do we Jews get out from under this suffering was assimilate. Just dump the whole Jewish thing and become a citizen of the world. Now, it was the first time in history that that was a slight possibility. You have the French Revolution, and you have the French state really is the first one that says to the Jews as individuals everything, to the Jews as a nation nothing. So as long as you were a Frenchman of the Mosaic faith, you got all civil rights. It was the first country that offered Jews complete civil rights. So there he is looking at that concept and in Europe and thinking, oh, that's what we need, is just to blend and we're just going to become whatever, not hold on to this nationhood concept. But then he was sent as a reporter to cover the Dreyfus trial. And when he saw that Dreyfus was stripped of his uniform and his sword broken and he was convicted and framed, and okay, that's bad enough that he was framed and convicted, but then the French street reacted with death to the Jews. And that made a huge impact on him because he said, if this place, this bastion of freedom, this place that could recognize the Jew as the Jew, that gives Jews complete civil rights, if the French streets erupt in death to the Jews, it means the Jews have no place to go. So he changed his mind and said the only way the Jews can get out from under their suffering is to become a normal people. Have a nation like every other nation, have their own land, have their own army, and be regular. That was his quest, to become regular, which is not the Jewish quest. We're chosen people, we're different, we're special. We're supposed to try to be special. He wanted to be regular. So Zionism was founded in becoming normal and becoming regular, which is why he was okay with any other state, Uganda or whatever he, you know, was offered. He was okay with that. Fortunately, there were others who had a little combination of the Jewish view and the view of the Jewish man mixed together, and they said, no, this has to happen in Palestine. Right, so that is where it happened in the end. But he's the one who started it. So the Zionism as a political philosophy is actually, in a way, an anti-Torah philosophy. So there was that rejection of it from the right-wing Torah crowd. But then there's a second objection, which is that in the Talmud, there is a covenant made between the Jewish people, God, a covenant between the Jewish people, God, and the nations. This is from Rabbi Beryl Wine. Don't think I know all this stuff. I just listened to a lot of tapes. So he explains that there's a covenant between the Jewish people, God, and the nations right at the exile, at the beginning of the Roman exile, where God promises the Jewish people that we won't disappear. The Jewish people promise God that they won't storm the wall and come back to the land through pressure. And the nations promise God and the Jews that they won't hurt us too much. Now, clearly, the nations broke their promise. So now the legal question is, are we still bound by our promise? God's still keeping his bargain. We haven't disappeared, even though they've tried mightily hard. But we haven't disappeared. So God's keeping his promise. The nations broke their promise. So now the question is, and the question in the middle of the 1800s, when there was more, when the trickle, there was always a presence, a Jewish presence in the land. But slowly, a few more people started to go back, and with the rise of nationalism throughout Europe and with the rise of Jewish nationalism in the form of Zionism, so more people started to go. So now there's a question. A, it's a secular movement, and B, it seems like we're now storming the wall. So the Satmar Rebbe said, this is storming the wall. You're not allowed. We cannot go back en masse. Trickle is one thing. En masse is totally forbidden. And so he put his foot down. So the Satmars are anti-Zionists. The Satmar Hasidic sect, Satmar. So, but then you have the rest. So now there's a lot of controversy during this time period. Are you allowed to? Aren't you allowed to? Are we bound by that promise? Aren't we bound by that promise? And then, of course, you have the rise of religious Zionism, which is taking the name Zionism and kind of retrofitting it back into the Torah concept of Yishuv Haaretz. We are supposed to be a nation state. We are supposed to have government. We are supposed to have garbage men and doctors and lawyers and gardeners and street sweepers and all of that. We're supposed to be a full nation with a full breadth of people in a nation so that we have the ability to shine a light to the entire world, everybody, no matter who they are. So that there should be a light shining for every single human being on the planet by the way the Jews are in the land. So Rav Kook, right-wing religious, was a spiritual Zionist. He went from the Kabbalistic side, who felt that even though this is a secular movement, everything on the planet has religious sparks in it, has Kabbalistic sparks, sparks from the breaking of the vessels, right? So, and that's a whole different story, but if you know what that story is, so the vessels broke that held the great light that was created in the beginning of time, and those sparks are scattered all around the world, and it's not until they're all gathered back and reassembled that the world will come to its ultimate perfection. So Rav Kook held that everything has sparks in it. It could have lots of peels on it. Lots of orange peel, lots of coverings, layers, yeah, klipot, called klipot. So you might have to dig for those sparks, but they're there. So he felt that there are sparks of holiness in secular Zionism, and that they actually merited somehow to start the movement and the flow of messianic times back to Israel. So there were those who believed that it's a secular movement altogether, you have to stay away from it. There are those who believed that they actually started the flow that is okay to follow, that we're released from the promise. So now we Jews can realize our yearnings and go back to Zion. And then there are those who say, actually, this is the messianic times. This is the natural thing to have happen. We are now seeing the ingathering of the exiles, which is the fulfillment of the prophecy. God is behind this. So the argument raged until the founding of the state. There were anti-Zionists, very strong anti-Zionists, until the founding of the state. Once the state was founded, it was a fact on the ground. And a lot of people flipped over. That's where you got the non-Zionists to say, the jury's still out, you know. So, and 10 years ago, it would be harder to understand that than it is right now. 10 years ago, the modern Orthodox were very strong Zionists, which they still are, and they said in their prayers, please God bless Israel, the beginning of the flowering of the ultimate redemption, which the right wing don't say that prayer. They say, please bless the state. If they say bless the state, they say bless it, but not the beginning of the flowering of the redemption. So that's because they're not sure. And today, everybody's less sure. You know, 10, 15 years ago, we were all kind of like thinking, Israel, it's here, it's here to stay. Now we're all kind of like biting our nails a little bit, thinking, I hope it works. I hope it lasts.
There's one sect that says that we don't come to Israel, we don't deserve Israel until the Mashiach comes.
Right, so then the question is, are we in the times of the Messiah, or do we have to wait for the Messiah? That seems to have been a battle, right? So today it seems like, in general, most people agree that we are in the times of the Messiah, and clearly, certainly with after the founding of the state, with all those miraculous winnings of the wars, particularly the 1967 war, and all of them were miraculous, but that was like to everybody, secular, religious, everybody saw that was total miracles, open miracles. So it's pretty clear that this is the hand of God. So there are plenty of people, there are very few anti-Zionists left. There are some non-Zionists who just are kind of, the jury's out, but they love the land, they want to live there. And Torah is there now. Torah wasn't there really, for real, before the founding of the state. There was Torah in Eastern Europe. A speck, one spark, jumped over into Western Europe, into Gateshead. And then most of it was wiped out with the war, but one spark also jumped to Lakewood, and then from there disseminated in this country. So now we have real Torah in America, which took a while to build, and we have real Torah in Israel, and the main Torah in Israel. But there wasn't main Torah there. Before the Second World War, if anybody wanted to send their kids to learn, which was rare, only the frumest of the frum were able to send a child, but they sent them to Europe to learn. You know, American kids were sent to Europe to learn. Hardly anybody went to Israel to learn. There was the Chevron Yeshiva. There weren't yeshivas really in Jerusalem. But there was the Chevron Yeshiva, and that's where that huge massacre was in 1927, where all the yeshiva boys were killed and dismembered, and it was a terrible massacre. So, and that's one of the Israel talking points, if you say settlements are the problem. So it wasn't a settlement then, it wasn't a state then, but the Arabs still wanted us out. So anyway, are we in a time of redemption? It sure looks like it. Is the jury still out? Well, I think it's still a problem. One way that I think it's possible to look at things, tragedies like the fire that just happened last week, is that we only deserve the land when we're behaving like Jews. It's a Jewish land for Jews to be Jewish in. And the Jewish role is to be a light unto the nation. So if we're just behaving regular, sometimes God needs to give us, and this is about the suffering class, God needs to give us a kick in the pants to behave differently. So sometimes it's to get us back on the path, but sometimes a fire like that, what does it do? It makes all of us feel like brothers and sisters. We love each other. We care for each other. I went on the OU website today and I looked at all the faces of those 42 who were killed and read who they are and their ages and their families and, you know, just to feel connected. Like, we lost all these people. It's so sad. And we donated. And the people who live in Israel opened their homes. 17,000 people lost. 17,000 people had to be evacuated and had to be taken in somewhere. They're taken into other people's homes. So it was a time of embrace. Harshness caused it, but what came out from the harshness, the squeezing of the olive, was kindness and chesed and caring and prayer and connection. So that's productive suffering. It could be restorative too, because we're not doing it without that. We should be doing it without that. So in a way it's restorative to get you back on the path. But it's also productive to cause what needs to happen to happen. So we don't yet deserve the land all the way through, and yet we deserve it enough that we have it. We must deserve it somehow because we have it. But we must not deserve it all the way because we're still struggling on a daily basis for it. So there's definitely spiritual pulls here. We're not a regular nation. And we're certainly not settled like Americans are in America. Yes, America did things they shouldn't have done. Yes, manifest destiny as we were manifesting destiny where we were running over other people's destiny. And yes, we took over Indians and brought smallpox and all kinds of stuff, but Americans are nice and settled in this country today, and nobody's really questioning if we have rights to it. I mean, you have a few little pockets, but basically the whole world agrees America belongs to the Americans. We're nice and comfortable here. But that's not the case with the Jews in Israel at all, not even inside ourselves. You look at the 20-year-old college students today, and they're so pro-Palestinian, it's scary. Jewish kids, it's frightening how they feel. So even inside ourselves, we're not settled that it belongs to us. And let alone, of course, everybody else. So yes, I say we're still in exile, even though a lot of us live there. And look at us, all sitting around this table, myself included. Why aren't we there? You know, something's exiled inside us that we're not thinking that I so desperately want to go there. Our ancestors all felt that they desperately wanted to go there. And they couldn't, but we can. And we're not. So there's something in exile there too. You know, what is that about? We're more comfortable here. It's easier. So we're here. So, I mean, not to judge. I'm just saying for my own self, it's hard to live there. So that's, and it's actually interesting. In the next week, probably, I'll bring the quote that says there are three things that we're given through suffering, and one of them is the land of Israel. It is not easy to live in Israel. Not at all. So suffering is the one of the prices that's paid for that. Okay, so back to this, after that digression. Okay, if you notice, I put little Hebrew letters there. What are those Hebrew letters? Does anybody recognize them? They're the letters of the dreidel. Oh, good. Except for they're a little bit out of order. So the letters of the dreidel are Nes Gadol Hayah Sham Nun Gimel Heshin. But these letters actually all relate to the four exiles. You know, the dreidel was, because there's a decree of no learning Torah, the dreidel was spun and it has Torah teachings in it. So right today we just play it with coins. It's just a game. But for the times when they couldn't learn Torah, they were able to spin the dreidel and learn through that, use mnemonics. So here's one of them, is the four exiles. What were they trying to destroy in us? The Babylonian exile was trying to destroy our nefesh. Right? Our life energizing force. Not our life, but our energizing force. That's which connects us to each other, to the land, to the service, our nefesh. So that's the nun. The Persian exile was trying to destroy our guf, our body. That's gimel vav fe, our body. So they wanted to kill us. So that's guf, gimel. The Greek exile was trying to destroy our sechel, right? Our intellect, our ability to think and have clarity. So that's the shin, is sechel.
What is it?
Sechel, shin chaf lamed, sechel, our intellect, our clarity of vision. And the Roman exile wants all of it, ha kol, the whole thing, all three of them.
What was that again?
Ha kol, the Roman exile is ha kol, means everything, everything, wants it all, ha kol. So that's what they were trying to destroy. Each one of those exiles is trying to destroy a different part of us. But here we are still today. How are we still here today? This is the Hanukkah part. Okay, next page. Oh, other side of the page. I have two pages. You have one. So we talked about the difference of the Greek exile, which is that we were actually still in the land, right? So it was a different exile in that it was our sechel that was in exile, not our bodies. In the other exiles, our actual bodies are out, or now we're still in exile. It's interesting. We say at the end of Yom Kippur and the end of the Seder, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim, We have Yerushalayim now. So if you're in Jerusalem, and sometimes even here, but for sure if you're in Jerusalem, what do you say? L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim? But you do. Next year in Jerusalem, right. We say next year in Jerusalem in the rebuilt Jerusalem. Because the Jerusalem of today, there's pork restaurants there. There's, you know, multiply pierced people there. There's people who hate each other there. You know, it's not Jerusalem that we need it to be. So we still, even people in Jerusalem say next year in Jerusalem, the rebuilt Jerusalem, the Jerusalem that it should be, not physically rebuilt, spiritually rebuilt. Physically, it's beautiful. most of it, right? It's physically a very beautiful city. And it's being built up like crazy. I mean, all the foreign investment now is building it. It's a gorgeous city, right? But internally, it's still not where it needs to be, the rebuilt Jerusalem. So the Greek exiles, the exile of the Seichel, the same type of exile that those Jews who live in Israel today are not fully out of. So what we do for this holiday is we light the menorah. So everybody knows the story. They want to relight the menorah. They get the temple back. They're looking for oil. They can't find the oil. What oil do you need? Right? So what is oil in Judaism? Do you know what it signifies? Also, a whole nother long conversation. So I can't go into the whole thing. So you just have to trust me on this. It signifies sechel. Oil is wisdom. Oil is what we use to anoint a Kohen Gadol, the high priest, to anoint a king, and also to consecrate vessels for the temple. There's a special oil that's made for temple service that's used for those three purposes, anointing kings, Kohen Gadols, and vessels. But the other oil that's used in the temple is the oil that's used for lighting of the menorah. That oil has to be made to even more stringent specifications than the first oil, and can only be made by pressing the olives still on the tree. So if you know how olive oil is made, right, you take all the olives and you put them in a press. I don't know how they make it today, but I've seen the ancient presses in Israel. Two big grinding stones, and they grind the stones until the oil comes out, and then strain it and you have your oil. Right? The oil for lighting the menorah has to be the purest oil possible. Shemen, Zeit, Zach. Zach is the root word that we use today for glass, see-through, totally pure. Zchuchit is glass. It's the same zach, zchuchit. So it has to be pure oil. And the oil for lighting the menorah had to be squeezed from the oil. So it's just one, like the first cold press, but even the first one. They're still on the tree. Just one drop, a little squeeze, it comes out. That's what they used for lighting the menorah. It had to be the purest of the pure because it represents sechel. It represents our thought. So now the Jews, and that's what's lighting up. You're lighting the menorah with the thought of the Jews. The Torah that we take in and that then gets processed through the Jew is what lights up the world, or what's supposed to light up the world. We're supposed to be an or l'goyim. We're supposed to be beacons of light. So the physical light that mirrors the spiritual light that we are supposed to be is the light that's in the menorah. So now, the war's over. Everybody has killed somebody or been in contact with somebody dead somehow, even if it's just passing by or under a roof or something like that. So everybody has the spiritual impurity of death, which takes 7 days to get rid of. Right? So in order to make the purest oil for the temple, you can't make it in that state. So it takes a day to make oil, 7 days to get over it, which means 8 days before you get new oil. Right? So really, under those circumstances, they could have used any oil. Just the idea is get the menorah lit again, and then you'll do it the best way when you can. But because of what it symbolized, the Jews were not satisfied with that. They wanted the purest, the cleanest, the right, the correct. Now, the oil that was in that flask of oil with the seal of the Kohen Gadol, it wasn't usually sealed with the Kohen Gadol. That's not the way it usually was. But really what the Jews were saying is, after this period of Hellenism, there must be one flask, at least, of pure, untainted Jewish wisdom. There's got to be something left over that they didn't get to. That's what we want to find, is that pure little bit of Jewish wisdom that they didn't sully. That's what we want to find, and that's what we want to light the menorah with. So that's what they were hunting for, and that's what they found, was one flask of pure, untainted Jewish wisdom to bring the light into the world. And it was a private miracle. We didn't even all see it. The menorah is inside the temple, not inside the courtyard where all the Jews go, inside the Kohen part where only the Kohanim go. So only they saw the miracle that it lasted for so long. So it's not really about the miracle that the oil lasted for longer. Really, there's a lot of different miracles that happen. There's the military victory and the fact that we cared, but I think really, and the fact that we sought it, I think that's the main miracle, is the fact that we cared enough to seek that level of purity. That we knew it was still there, and that we sought it out, and that's what we wanted. And that's why we celebrate Hanukkah today. There's tons of miracles in our history. What are we celebrating? Oil burned for 8 days. Whoop-de-doo. You know, compared to all the other things that happened, people coming back to life and wars being won and plagues being, you know, all kinds of stuff. Oil for 8 days and we have a whole holiday throughout the generations? Really, that can't be the miracle that we're celebrating. It's really the miracle of the Jews knowing that there's something special. We have a light to shine and it's pure. And we seek it and we'll shine it and we have access to it. It's through that that we dedicate our lives to that type of wisdom and disseminating it. That's why Hanukkah means dedication. Dedicating the temple, temple's gone. Why are we celebrating? Because it's about dedicating ourselves to that wisdom. And that's what the whole holiday is about, is finding that purity in the negative world, in the darkness. So if you think about it, God's holidays, the ones in the Torah, start with Passover. That's the first one. They go through Shavuot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Simchas Torah, Shemini Atzeret, done. Right? So God's holidays are in the period of light. Our holidays, the ones that we made, Hanukkah and Purim, are in the period of dark, in the period of suffering, in the time of night. Right? God lights up the light, but then he pulled back and said, okay, now you guys go. It's your opportunity to show what you're made of, but not just show what you're made of. It's not a test. Let me see if you can do it. It's a, come on, you could do it. You can walk on your own. Just like a parent lets go of their child and they know they're going to fall and it's going to hurt and they're going to cry. But only by doing that, by causing them the pain, really what they're doing is causing them to walk and be independent. And so that's the productive suffering, really, is that we're in this period of night. Temple gone, connection gone, revealed miracles gone, revealed prophecy gone. None of that is there for us. We're here in this period of darkness. But we're here. A lot of us aren't here. But everybody who's in this room is here, right? And the other Jews that you know are Jews who for 3,500 years have hung on. For 3,500 years since Sinai until today, if you're Jewish, and you're born Jewish, or if you converted Jewish, that means you knew some Jews, right? So you got connected that way. Let's just say. Oh, I have to give you a break in a minute. But anyway, if you're Jewish and you were born Jewish, that means that for 3,500 years, your family survived physically and spiritually. You chose in every single generation, even if the choices were a little weaker the last few generations. Right? The whole reason you're here is because you're a light. And your family cared enough to bring you here. That's how you're here. That's the miracle of Hanukkah. That is the miracle of Hanukkah, right? So that's what I wanted you just to see. So just look quickly, and we'll skip the bottom, but just look at these three Hebrew words. Hashemen, the oil, right? That's what the miracle was done through. That's what we talk about as a miracle. Rearrange those letters, you get Shmona, right? Do you see that right below? Shmona is 8 days of Hanukkah. What is 8, though? 8 is above 7. 7 is the realm of nature. 8 is above nature. And that's what the Jew is, totally above nature, which is why we're circumcised on the 8th day. 8 is the realm of, look at the next word, rearrange the letters, neshama, soul.
Soul?
Soul. So you have Hashemen, the oil, Shmona, 8, and neshama, soul, is all the same letters. Just rearrange them. And you get this concept of Hanukkah, that through that miracle of the oil, of the seichel, of the Jewish wisdom, in the 8th day, being above nature, that's the realm of the soul. That's the light that the Jew brings to the world. So there you go. That's Hanukkah and suffering all in one class. And we'll continue, hopefully, next week, the rest of the suffering.
What do you know about the Italians accepted Judaism for 2 years before they went to Christianity? What do you know about that?
Are you talking about the Romans that maybe flirted with Judaism?
They accepted it for 2 years.
I'm not familiar with that they accepted it for 2 years. I know that there are a lot of Romans that converted.
Yeah.
For instance, Uncles, the translator into Aramaic of the Torah.
That's Saul, or Paul, what they call him. He went for Jesus there.
Right.
Right. Then they switched over to Jesus.
Right.
But originally the Romans were Jewish.
I don't think so. Originally the Christians were Jewish.
I read that somewhere.
Interesting.
That might be a possibility. When I was in Rome many years ago, we were looking at some ruins near the Colosseum, and it was Hebrew and Latin. Must have been an old temple or something, you know. But there were some ruins, and there was actually
That's what I was told one time.
Excuse me, I'm not familiar with that, but that's it's possible. My understanding is that the Romans were about conquering and absorbing, which is why you might see Hebrew being absorbed in some Jewish ritual. They didn't want to convert to Judaism because it's a lot of work. And there's circumcision. Not the most pleasant procedure for a grown adult.
Not only that, but there is Hebrew writing in the Tennessee or Alabama, so the caves, there's Hebrew writing in the cave. So they say, and some of the Jews wandered over to the Americas before Columbus.
Huh, interesting. You never know, it might have been the angel Moroni who wrote that.
The writing was in Hebrew. I read that somewhere also. They sort of quieted it down.
Well, I'll just say this about that.
They don't want to publicize it.
We're all over the world.
I know.
We got sparks to redeem everywhere. So that would put us in every corner, which is one reason why we were exiled to the entire world, to help liberate those sparks and bring them back. So that's what we're doing today.
There were Jews in China.
Yeah. Right.
What surprised me.